So, in Buddhism, it's not new age teachings. It's not old age teachings. It's no age teaching. The ageless, the timeless, the akalika dhamma. No age at all. New age, old age, no age. Because actually, most people here are old age, aren't they? It's not new age. So, that you can try it out. See what it is. I am happy and well. Actually, that does make an interesting point there. Are you happy? Or are you miserable? Which one is it? Or are both there all together? It depends which one you're going to watch, which one you're going to pay attention to. Because there's a lot of times that life, this is one of those insights you have, is that life is just the simile I gave years ago. Because I remember when I was a kid, because many of you are old like me, that you understand the simile. We used to be given these colouring books. And all it was like black lines on white paper. And you have to colour it in, and then you get an elephant. Or you colour it in, and then you get a tree. And it's like those colouring books. And I think that's very similar to what life is. We've just got these black lines on white paper, and we colour it in. So you've got a meditation retreat like this, and say, whoa, it's a meditation retreat. You can colour it in with misery. Or you can colour in with, great, a meditation tree. Isn't this beautiful? Isn't it wonderful? Like me, I can actually come into this question time and use it on another sort of, what is a question time? Why me? Or I can first say, great, questions. I can have fun with this. So really, so you can colour in your life with happiness or misery. So in that sense, you can say, may I be happy. Or rather, I will be happy. Or I am happy. What you're doing is you're colouring the happiness on the black and white lines of ordinary life. And that's very important, because when you're actually watching the peaceful pieces of meditation, whether it's a breath or whatever, you can actually add the colour of beauty to it. And you're watching the breath going in, breath going out. Look at it and see its beauty. It's beautiful in there. It's a lovely breath. It's a wonderful, soft breath. As I said the other day, like a baby, like this beautiful sort of like flower opening up and then closing. This beautiful rhythm of your being. Isn't that wonderful? It's the very fact that, you know, this, you're vibrating with the energies of the universe. The breath going in, the breath going out. Whatever it is, you can actually start making this really alive and very, very beautiful. Because sometimes, you know, you can look at a flower, you've been told that a flower is beautiful. But as a monk, sometimes we do these exercises in perceptions. We actually make the beautiful look ugly. We make the ugly look beautiful, just to show that we can do this. So sometimes I see those beautiful flowers in the garden, and I think, just look at all the pollen there, they're pushing out, all those people with hay fever. Those stupid flowers, taking away all the oxygen just next to me. So you can look at those filthy, disgusting, dirty flowers. Sometimes you do that just to play around. And you can do that. You can look at what's supposed to be beautiful as being the most ugly thing. And then you look at what's ugly. You look at what goes down in the toilet. It's just the rich browns and the softness and that just rich smell. So you can play around with things like that. Whatever you're doing, you actually realize that what you're doing, because imagine that's to a fly in Australia or to a bug. Oh, that's delicious. That's amazing. That's beautiful stuff. So what is that beauty actually in the shit itself? Or is it actually what we add on to it? Well, that actually came from an old story which Ajahn Sumedho used to tell, because when he was in Wat Pa Phong, Ajahn Chah's monastery in the early days, he was having such a hard time. And of course, it was written all over his face, he was suffering. And Ajahn Chah came up to him and said, Sumedho, is Wat Pa Phong suffering, or are you suffering? Which one is it? And he had to admit, it's nothing to do with the monastery. That wasn't suffering. It was what he was adding to it. That was what the suffering was. So you can be in a meditation retreat like this. Now, is it your body is suffering? Or is it what you add on to it? I don't want the pain. I don't want the mosquitoes. I don't want the tiredness. I don't want the mind always thinking about this and that. I don't want this. I want to have jhana like everybody else. You know that you are the only one who hasn't got it yet. That's what we think, because you make the suffering. So because of that, we're colouring it in. So because we colour it in, actually you can say that, yeah, my breath is happy. My mind is peaceful. That's why I said, imagine your mind is peaceful. Just imagine for a few moments what it would be like to have no thoughts in the mind. Imagine what it would be like to be so still. Imagine what it would be like to be in jhana. Just imagine. I gave you a good description this morning. Just close your eyes. Imagine. You're very close. Imagine you're just like this hermit who's left the whole world. You've got no family. You've got no job. You've got no husband, no wife, no children. You've got no responsibilities. You've got no money. You've got no fears. Imagine you've completely left the world. Isn't this wonderful? That's another thing you can actually do at the beginning of a meditation. When I said the happiest time, sometimes you can imagine yourself sitting on top of this mountain, this beautiful monastery on a deep cave. Because I like caves, not top of mountains. So sometimes I start my meditation. Some of the caves I've been to are just really nice. You just imagine yourself, even though there's many people around, imagine yourself sitting in a cave. In a deep, cool, still cave. Imagine that. Straight away you've got the peace. You're resonating. You're making peace. You're making the stillness. You're making the bliss. So it's just not, may I be happy. May I be peace. May I be stillness. May I be that amazing, vibrant silence. So yeah, do that. It's great. Good fun. That's not new age. That's not new old age. That's no age. No age. Zero age meditation. Judge, does anyone want to say anything about that? No? Good. Dhyan Brahm. Does one have to surrender to the teacher's ways and means of practice whether one agrees or not? Ha, surrender. Yes, you must laugh at my jokes, whether you like it or not. No, you must never agree to the teacher. You must rebel. Because the last thing you want is a group of automatons, a group of yes people who agree with everything you say. Isn't that right? Yeah. No, because if you do it that way, it's just, it's just like following the signposts. You know, the old saying of, in Zen Buddhism about the person, they point into the moon, they just saw the finger, not the moon. You just follow the teacher, you just follow the signposts, you're just eating the menu. You're not actually saying, what's the teacher pointing to? You don't have to follow the teachers like that, that's just blind following. The whole point of a teacher, as I mentioned this very often, the whole point of the teacher is to get rid of you. For those of you who come to many, many retreats, retreat after retreat after retreat, it's a sign that I'm the biggest failure. If I was really a good meditation teacher, you come once, become enlightened, never need to come back again. So, is it you or is it the teacher? But the point is that the idea of a teacher is actually to empower you. All the teachings which I give, I want you to sort of investigate. And you're not supposed to take everything like a buffet, you get sick. Or advice which I've been giving you over this, even a few days so far, is enough to fill your brain up sort of 10 times over with things to think about. You just take one or two things which work, put them into practice, and you see it for yourself. So you see that if you look at, to listen to, say, what Ajahn Chah taught, what I teach, it's not the same. If you look at what Ajahn Chah taught and what his teacher, Ajahn Mun taught, it's not the same. It's always slightly different because everyone sees it in a different way. And you give it your own descriptions, your own metaphors, your own sort of ways of looking at things. And it's great to have that. So you don't become like a clone of your teacher. You don't surrender to the teacher, you surrender to letting go. Surrender to the silence. You surrender to the breath. You surrender to the limiter. That's what you surrender to. So one of the similes which I give, is that when the limiter comes up, sometimes we don't know how to really let go, surrender that last bit. So I tell people, sometimes when a limiter comes up, just imagine, get the feeling. You don't have to visualize too much, otherwise a limiter will go. Imagine that now you've been driving your car, now you take the keys out and give it to the person sitting next to you. And give the steering wheel as well, and all the pedals, here you go, you look after it now. And that way is a way of like letting go of control. You say, mind, now you look after it. Just like you give the keys of your engine, you, to the mind. You can take over now. I'm not going to do any more. I've gone this far, got to a limit, and now you take over. So I call that giving the keys to the mind, the limiter stage. And when actually you feel like doing that, it's just a way of describing what actually you're doing inside. You give up control, you let go, you abandon driving your mind. The mind drives itself. So if you have little ideas like that, you understand what surrender is. It's just not surrendering one will to another person's will, it's surrendering all will altogether. Everything stops. Because a lot of times surrender means you just do what you're told, and somebody else's will controls you. But this is the ending of all will, the ending of all instructions, the ending of all movement. It is slightly different. Actually, it's profoundly different. So that's actually what you do. You don't surrender to somebody else. Everything surrenders. The whole world stops. Is that okay? Okay, next question. There's lots of questions to go here. If a person could use the silence between thoughts in the present moment as a meditation object, I presume that with practice the silence becomes longer. If it being happened in this is a meditation as well, I presume it could even be the beautiful silence of the present moment. Brilliant. If so, why bother with breath meditation at all? Why not just take the silence all the way to nimittas and jhanas? Very good question, and it works. You can get the beautiful silence up very, very quickly, and this silence is so nice, so nice. Very often, because what's happening, again, using that symbol, the five senses and the breath, so the five senses and the mind, if you silence the five senses, the mind will come up, that's the nimitta coming up. Usually the way to silence the five senses is to take one sense, which is the touch of the breath. So all the other parts of the five senses disappear. Just got that last bit of sense, the feeling of the breath. When that softens down and disappears, then the mind manifests. But however, if you're in the silence, if you're in the present moment, there's nothing much the five senses can do anyway. They will be subdued, and the nimitta will very probably come up from there. You can bypass the breath. However, that's a very nice thing to do. If you can do it, if you can make that silence very profound, very beautiful, yeah, you will get nimittas coming up. So whoever asks that question, you're getting the message, you're getting the idea. Another way of looking at meditation, one which is true to the account of the Buddha, it doesn't matter what the meditation object is, it's actually how you're watching that meditation object. In other words, the whole way of meditation, in this particular way of looking at it, is just subduing the five hindrances. So when you start meditating, you've got those hindrances, and your whole purpose of meditation is to knock those hindrances off. So there's no hindrances at all. It's to calm, silence the hindrances. So that your object is not to watch the silence, watch the present moment, or watch the silence, or watch the breath, or watch the nimitta. The whole purpose becomes knocking out the five hindrances. Now that's a classic description of the Buddha about how to meditate. It gives another way of looking at it. So really it's not what you're watching, whether it's a silence or whatever, it's how you're watching it, to make sure you're not doing it with desire, not doing it with ill will. The restlessness is being subdued, no remorse, there's no sloth and torpor, the doubt is going. It's all those five hindrances. Once they've gone, in other words, once you're letting go, once you're developing compassion, once you're just making peace with every moment, which is the opposite of restlessness, pure and not falling into the five hindrances, they're being subdued, the meditation starts to work all by itself. As long as there's no five hindrances there, the mind will become still, it will become happy, which is the piti sukha, the nimitta will arise, and the door into jhanas is wide open. So the reason why they're called hindrances is because they stop. You're getting deep in meditation. It's another important point, I'll maybe probably mention this tomorrow morning in the talk on deep insight, that as you are meditating, if you ever come across a blockage, you can't go further, it's as if you're stuck somewhere, that must be a hindrance. Instead of using willpower, trying to force yourself deeper, just you look and see, what hindrance is it? Because if there wasn't a hindrance happening, you would automatically just develop deep and deeper peace, more bliss, nimitta as a whole works. It must be a hindrance there somewhere, blocking your progress. That's why sometimes if you come across a blockage, one of the most common hindrances is ill will. Surprising just how common that is. So whatever state of meditation you're in, you develop loving kindness. Oh, this is good enough. And if you're, you know, you're watching the breath, you can't go further, beautiful breath, you're okay, this is good enough for me, the door of my heart's open to this, whatever happens. And by opening the door of your heart to the state of meditation you're in now, what actually you're doing, you're overcoming the blockage for it deepening, the ill will is being undermined. And if that really was a hindrance which was stopping you progressing, when you say, ah, oh, this is good enough for me, the door of my heart's open to this, I embrace this moment, even though it may not be very deep, this is good enough. With that degree of loving kindness, it overcomes the hindrance and very soon you just go deeper. You've overcome the blockage through loving kindness. If it's like restlessness there, you just open, just calm down, shh. And if whatever you are in meditation, whatever object is in the mind, just calm, calm, that becomes a restlessness. So whatever it is, you can actually do something in the sense of you're doing opposite of one of the hindrances, which is another way of saying letting go. And if it's the right thing, you go deeper. So that's another way of actually understanding the path of meditation. Not the series of steps which I've shown, but the underlying reason why you're doing those steps. Those steps are a sign that the hindrances are disappearing. But instead of actually looking at the steps, you're looking at the cause those steps manifest. The presence and the calming down of the five hindrances. So sometimes in your meditation, it's not so much what you're experiencing, how you're experiencing it. If it's silence, and it's beautiful silence, and you're resting in there, you know many of the hindrances are going away. So obviously, nimittas must come up from there. Whoever asked that question yet, that is valid. Any question about that? Okay, here comes the next question. Dear Ajahn, can we have more Dhamma talk time, please? More than anything, it helps a lot. Thanks. Maybe 4 to 5pm or something like that. My goodness. Trying to squeeze more out of it. The best Dhamma talk of all. It's not given by Ajahn Brahm. It's not given by Ajahn Chah. It's not even given by the Buddha. The best Dharma talk of all is when you are unconditionally mindful, listening to this moment. And the moment is the Dharma talk. So listen, every moment between 4 and 5pm, there's a Dharma talk going on. So people have to be listening. So you have a Dharma talk in every moment. It's a Dharma talk. Anicca, it's passing. Look already, it's, what day is Wednesday evening already. How many days have passed? See, Anicca is talking to you. Dukkha is talking to you. The person next to me is making a noise. See, Dukkha is teaching a sermon. And Anatta, you're completely out of control. You've been trying to get these jhanas all the last 4 or 5 days. You haven't achieved anything yet. because you're completely out of control. Nothing to do with you. It doesn't belong to you. If it did belong to you, you'd be able to say, Jana, come. So it's been teaching you every four or five every day there has been a Dharma talk going on. So, tomorrow being four or five, listen. If a person is kind, keeps precepts, is considered virtuous, but does not do much active charity, like organizing retreats, visiting homes, becoming vice president of Buddhist society, etc. Now that's very high charity. The person is in the second line of passion. Person is in the second line of passion, don't know what that means. Doing things within his vicinity, friends, family, giving money to charities, but not in the front line. Okay, raising funds. This is what most people are. Should they go forth and try to remove the shell, overcome their shyness, and try to be more in the things, or can they stay where they are comfortable with and continue to donate quietly, passively, and meditate to keep filling the jar? Yeah, I mean, just whatever you feel that you can contribute, even if it's a person behind the scenes, the power behind the meditation seat, whatever it is, however you can contribute, you just contribute however you feel appropriate. So you don't all have to become president of the Buddhist Society or vice president of the Buddhist Federation or whatever it is. So if you can keep your kind, keep precepts and consider it virtuous, that by itself is doing charity. Because charity is just giving up, letting go of your own concern for the sake of what needs to be done. So sometimes that's a very beautiful thing to do, and you don't need to worry about ego. But if, you know, somebody you need to, they need a vice president and you're sort of free, go and do it. Because it's not as if you're doing it for ego, and it's not as if that you're ashamed of, you know, doing things. So just whatever you need to do, you just do it. Sometimes I look at myself and sometimes I'm right in front of things, being the big shot. Sometimes I'm in my cave, being the no shot at all. So, you know, which one is really me? Just recently I got this medal, you know, for the John Curtin medal, for something or other. You laugh, yeah. But one of the things I noticed is okay. But what actually, the reason you get that medal is actually because the more you let go of your own, you know, your own self concern, the more you get honoured. I thought it's a marvellous thing. The more you let go of ego, the more the little which is left is honoured. And that's really quite neat. So if you let go of ego a lot, you get honoured even more. Because though anyone has been a president or vice president or the abbot or whatever, you're in really the firing line. If you've got an ego, you soon get shot down. So if you've got an ego, you can't survive. So the less ego you have, the more you can do those things. So if you want to do those things, that's fine. Go and be a treasurer, be a president, be a vice president or secretary or whatever. And this is just a way of serving. Someone's got to do it. So out of bodhisattva compassion, you can decide, yes, I will try that. See what happens. Whatever you do, you can always make a practice of it. And it's actually testing you out to see whether you have got an ego or not. To see whether you are proud. To see whether you get guilty or embarrassed when it all falls apart. When things go wrong. So it's good to do things like that. But whatever you want to do, you'll be in things or out of things. It's not whether you're in or, you know, right in the center of things or whether you're around the back. It's not whether you're in the front line or the back line. Both lines get shot up if you're not smart. So what's most important is that the way you're in the front line or the way you're in the back line. If you're in the back line out of fear or out of laziness, and that's not good. If you're in the front line, because look at me, that's not good either. That makes sort of sense? What it is if you're in the front line, you have front line persons suffering. If you're in the back line, you have back line people suffering. If you're the abbot, you have abbot suffering. If you're the junior monk, you have junior monk suffering. There's all suffering, so who cares? Dear Ajahn, what's the difference between entering into samadhi and entering into jhana? Also, can our nimitta get out from our body and meet with other nimittas? Sounds a bit incestuous, this. At least the male nimittas should go out and otherwise our baby nimittas come out. First of all, a nimitta is neither male or female, which is great. It's interesting. All your maleness and femaleness, your gender stops with your body and the five senses. When you go to nimittas, you go beyond gender. So the nimitta is actually common, or the mind, common to all people. It's not female, not male. And can you get out from my body and meet with other nimittas? Now, if you're inside, you can't go anywhere. You're sort of inside this beautiful, still place inside, so you can't go out anywhere. Going out, is what I said in the first talk, is the arsals, the outflowings of the mind. This is the inflowing, you come inside the nimitta. So you're in, nicely tucked away in cozy nimittas. And samadhi and entering jhana. The jhana is actually what the Buddha called samma samadhi, which is like perfect samadhi or correct samadhi, whatever you used to call it. So samadhi is just like the stillness, the sustained attention, the peace, the fruit of letting go. And so the jhana is when that samadhi becomes what the Buddha said, really neat samadhi, good samadhi, pure samadhi. So that's just, sometimes we call it samadhi, sometimes we call it jhana, but that's what it really means. Any questions on that? Okay, next one, here we go. What happiness if a person dies while in jhana? How would he or she still achieve enlightenment and get stuck in the samsara? Would there be more copies of books to share? Example like the Still Voice Pool. Where can we get a copy? Who can help accept donations for monastery BSWA? Can it be in different currency? Thank you. Words of talk, special answers. One question each. Okay, number one. What happens if a person dies while in jhana? Okay, there's two possibilities if you die while you're in jhana. First of all, if you're not a stream winner yet, when you die in jhana, you get reborn in the jhana realms. You stay there for eons, blitzed out for eon upon eon upon eon. So this is much higher than any heaven realm. Because when you're in a jhana, I've told you how stable it is, and the body dies, it's nothing really to disturb that jhana for a long time. So you live in this beautiful, blissful state for many eons. When that jhana finishes, you come get reborn according to karma. But the purity of that state and the imprint of it, chances are you're going to sort of, when you come back, you have a natural ability for meditation. To be able to recreate that state probably very easily. You'd be inclining towards some sort of religious, monastic, letting go, peaceful hermit type of life. So you don't lose it. It just imprints on your mind. And if you've got enough good karma, you get reborn in a Buddha age, and then you come on a retreat like this, it's easy. You've been doing it for the last few eons. However, if you're a stream winner, and you die in jhana, there's this wonderful special case, you become automatically promoted to being a non-returner. It's called a jhana anagami, a jhana non-returner. So, if you're a stream winner, you've got that stage, you haven't got any higher, and you die in jhana, automatic promotion. Which means you go into that jhana realm, but you never come back from there. When that jhana disintegrates, so do you. Your parinibbana. Just like the Buddha. And the reason is because in the stream winning attainment, you've let go so much with wisdom. In the jhana, you've let go with the mind. There's nothing left for actually to bring you back. It means that your way out of samsara, the way out of suffering, you die in jhana, you just bliss, bliss, bliss for eon upon eon upon eon. And then when that disappears, everything stops, nirvana. Wonderful way to go out, don't you think? So, either way, it's a great way to die. So, first of all, get into jhana, and then die. Yeah?
It seems like two steps promotion there.
Yeah, two steps promotion. Yeah.
Two steps. Huh?
Two steps, yeah. And the reason is, you know, it's because of the amount of letting go which has happened already. And because of the stream, there's nothing really to bring you back. So the jhana...
It doesn't depend on which jhana
No, any old jhana. Even the first jhana. Your jhana and agami never come back again. That's why the jhanas are incredible states of letting go. And if you... The Buddha actually called that happiness of jhana, one of the things he called it was Sambodhisukha, which is enlightenment happiness. And when I read that, I thought, you can't say, well, actually I thought that, you know, I was actually questioning the Buddha, said, Buddha, you can't say that. It's not enlightenment. Everybody knows that, but the Buddha actually called it enlightenment happiness. Why is he saying that? And the point is, it's so close to enlightenment. The Buddha even would actually, okay, let's call it enlightenment happiness, it's close enough. You're getting a taste of what enlightenment is in first jhana. This is the first jhana, rather than the other ones. Because people say, what is enlightenment? You can explain it in words, but you want to taste it. And this is actually the first real taste through experience of what enlightenment is. So this is actually how you can know what this nibbana business is all about, what enlightenment is all about. That's why enlightenment is not just sort of a dull state. It's incredibly powerful. It's blissful. That's why the Buddha said enlightenment is the highest happiness. You're getting a taste of it. So it's great to be able to do that. And if you get that taste and you stay in that taste, and you die, my goodness, you're so close that you just stay in that jhana afterwards, you're gone. Your attachments will disappear. Yeah!
We're talking about death and all that. Is there, if you go to a heavenly realm, which I guess is below the eon jhana realm, do you eat?
Aha! In the heavenly realms, do you eat? And what do you eat? In the lower realms, you eat fine food. But there are some devas, they're called pitibhaka devas. They eat joy. It's a wonderful thing of calling that. In other words, it's a joy which sustains them. Not physical food, not even the fine material food, but it's a sheer joy of being here. It keeps the mind energized. Yeah, that becomes the fuel, the joy. Now that's actually very interesting, because that actually shows what real food actually is. It's actually the fuel which keeps the body going. What keeps the mind going? In that particular state, joy keeps the mind going. For some people, it's ill will, anger keeps their mind going. And that's the food of the hell realms. Actually, the fear is the food of the animal realms. Greed is the food of the hungry ghost realms. And I think it's ill will is the food of the hell realms. It's really profound. This is what keeps it going. Which is why, in the hell realms, if you can get a moment of loving kindness, you die from the hell realms. You get reborn somewhere else. Because the food is taken away.
In the lower heavenly realms, you said people actually,
eat? Sort of like imaginary food. Now, imagine, like, nice, juicy hamburger. Can you smell it? Now, if you're in heavenly realms, it would almost like appear. It would be like you're eating it. You can taste it. Whatever you think of disappears. But it's not like a solid hamburger like down here. It's like a mind-made hamburger with all its taste, all its flavour. But because it's mind-made, you don't get indigestion.
And it actually sustains that?
Yeah, it sustains you.
So Arjun, if you're aware of the devas and that makes you happy and send them joy. Is that feeling?
It's an interesting one, yeah. Sometimes it's, yeah, it's true actually. It would be feeding them, but they get their own joy very easily. But yeah, actually, you're giving them it for me, I suppose. That's correct.
Did you use a good idea to hang out with those? Like two characters being able to hang out with you?
Well, it's really, you don't really hang out with Davis, they choose to come to you, they've got more power. So you may think that you're sort of controlling them, but no, they call the shots.
So is it meditation which would draw them in? Each day of meditation will draw them to you?
I suppose so, yeah. But I suppose there are deep states of meditation when you can visit the Deva realm, so I suppose you can actually go there. But that's only if you've got a very powerful mind. And without a powerful mind means you, you know, you do become more powerful than the Devas. Yeah.
When you were told the story about was it King Rama the Fifth? Oh, yes.
I
mean, that suggests that he was in the Deva realm.
Correct.
He had died and been reborn in the Deva realm and he could come back here as himself.
Correct, yeah.
But then how does that tie in with himself?
Okay, you're talking about the story about King Rama the Fifth and that American who became a monk, still a monk. And who was assisted by one of the kings of Thailand. When a person passes away, it's just a stream of consciousness, what most Christians or Hindus would call a soul, but when you actually look at it in more depth, you see that it's not a continuous thing, it's a cause and effect relationship. Just the same way as if you look upon a beach, you think it's a continuous strand of sand. If you look at it a bit more closely, you see it's particles of silica, with even gaps between the spaces between the sand particles. It's not a continuous flow of sand. The same way you see the stream of consciousness is just like particles, events of consciousness. And there's gaps between them. There is no consciousness. Like one conscious moment is finished, another one is yet to arise. So you can see there's nothing going across. There's no soul, there's no essence which is there all the way along. So that way you can understand how there can be rebirth from one realm into another. It's just you call King Rama the Fifth because that was his history. And same as, you can remember your past life, it may be a different name, but if that's a famous person, sometimes you say, oh, that's me reborn.
So somebody, can get drawn back. What would have brought him back?
What keeps him looking after that place. He was one of the main sponsors. It was his monastery. So he's still got interest down there. There's a bit of attachment. Just to make sure everything's okay.
And so someone might come back from the day around to you?
Yeah. For example, say if I was a monk and I went off on the day where I died, come back to the monastery just to make sure the monks are behaving themselves. No, don't do it, just to help out. Because you look after, you care for these places. In the same way that many devas care for the holy places in India. They look out for it. It's important to them. It's like holy places, it's like shrines. So there's heaps of devas around, there's holy places in India. That's where you feel the power.
Is that the power, is it?
One of the main reasons. Okay, now, number two. Would there be more copies of books to share? An example like the Still Forest Pool, where we can get a copy. Got some copies in Nonamara. Can you ask Lynn when she comes to get some more? Okay, that's easy. The only reason I brought those, because I was visited Nonamara on the Sunday, and this was the evening before someone said they were so desperate they were reading the Bible. Let's speak some Buddhist books. Number three. How can we help accept donation to the monastery or BSO? Can it be in different currency? Yeah, we're so desperate we'll receive anything, even the lottery. IOUs would also do. So sort of talk about that afterwards at the end. Would the talk question Q&A be a BSW website? So what do you do with the talks?
CDs are available later.
CDs will be available later on. Okay. Yeah.
Will the CDs have the question and answer as well as the talk?
Yeah, there we go. Next question. There are some who would always be at the kitchen before lunch, sneaking to the table. When the monks are here, they will serve the food, even though they have not helped in the preparation. Is this considered dharma? Some would just stand aside, generously allowing them to serve, taking the bodhisattva attitude. Is this also considered dharma? Yeah, it doesn't matter. If somebody really wants to serve, let them serve. Some people just get off on serving the monks, and it's just lovely to actually just to help. So it doesn't matter if you didn't cook or didn't prepare, if you want to sort of offer some food, fine. If you want to let somebody else do that, that's fine. So it's just the story I tell that when I was first as a monk in northeast Thailand, after alms round, when the monks would come back and Ajahn Chah, the great teacher, would come back, because you were walking barefoot in the sandy soil, your feet did become dirty. We'd actually wash our feet before we came into the dining hall. When Ajahn Chah came back, all these monks rushed out to wash his feet. And I thought, that's really stupid. Ajahn Chah, he's old enough to wash his own feet. And even if he did sort of, you know, want to help him wash his foot, sure, he'd just be like on a roster, but you know, you do it today, and then you do it the next day. Because he only got 2 feet. But yeah, right. These 2 people at most, that's efficiency. But it wasn't that, you got about 10 people were on each foot. I thought that's really so, that's superstition, but it got really stupid to like an ex-physicist from Cambridge. And I couldn't work it out, and so because I was a scientist, I decided, okay, the only thing to do is give it a try. So I also jumped up. And you had to be fast. Because if you were slow, you didn't even get anywhere near it. And I was really fast, and I beat the other monk. I got the toe all to myself. And it was bliss. I could actually wash one of the toes of my teacher. I felt so happy. And then I realized why monks were doing this. Just to do service, which is a wonderful thing. So I can understand now just why it is that sometimes people rush to the table just to, I want to be the one that offers a bit of food today, please, please, please. And isn't that lovely? I think it's really beautiful. It doesn't really matter who it is. If I see people fighting, give me the spoon, I'm not saying, yeah, there's a big fight in the kitchen, I think that's marvellous. Because you're fighting over doing something good. Like, you know, sometimes some of the duties we have in our monastery. Sometimes, in some places, you just think, oh, I did the cleaning of the toilets last week. It's someone else's turn this week. And the monastery said, no, give it to me. I want to do it. Or you do it before anyone else actually. You do it in the early morning before it's handed out, so you get all the merit. So this is the wonderful thing. When you understand what this is about, service is all about, it's not give it to someone else. You just want to do it because it's a privilege to help. It's a privilege to serve. So you just want to do it. Now that's a person who's understood what good karma is all about, what service is all about. It's not a chore. When you're giving your duties on this retreat, it's not a chore. Oh, why am I giving so many duties? It's amazing. I've got the job of giving the breakfast to the monks. Wow, that's a plum job. Whatever it is, you're like, it's about serving. So that's why that, you know, if people want to do it, that's fine. Let them get in there early and serve. So just get joy that people want to do something good. And all you do is when, if you don't get the spoon and you see someone else serving, you just don't feel jealous. Oh, why is it them again? You just stand by and just say, sadhu, sadhu, I rejoice with your offering. And then the two of you get exactly the same good karma. It's So instead of feeling jealous, why him or why her, you say, isn't it good, it's you. I rejoice in your good karma of being able to serve the monks today and serve the sister. Then you get exactly the same good karma. Then two of you get good karma. But if you say, oh, why is it? It's always him. Every day is him. Then he's getting good karma, but you're getting bad karma. Okay. Next question. Any questions on that one? Very, very good. Okay. What should we do when in bed for sleep? You should sleep. Obvious. Should we do loving kindness meditation or letting go? Okay. Before you go to sleep, you can do loving kindness meditation. When it's time to sleep, just sleep. No complication. If you do letting go meditation or loving kindness, it's great. But when it's time to sleep, sleep. Dajabal, do you think that each one of us has a specific destiny to fulfill in our lifetime? A specific purpose? And if you do, how can one find that destiny and live it? This is your destiny. If this wasn't your destiny, you wouldn't be here. What is your advice on living life from the heart? Thank you very much, Ajahn. Okay. The thing is that all this destiny business, you can always change your destiny at any moment. So, your destiny is in your hands. You can alter it. You can navigate it. You've obviously got inclinations, but you can always do something else. So because of that, that karma is always in flux. So there's nothing like destiny, nothing like that you are bound to do this. Anyone who goes to a fortune teller, you should remember the phrase which I say, never trust a poor fortune teller. If they're not filthy rich, they're not a good fortune teller. They can't even tell their own fortune, but how they can tell yours. So, we don't go to fortune tellers. And the destiny, because the future is always uncertain, it's always changing. So you may have an inclination, you can always change it. And how do you find that destiny and live it? You don't know what's happening next. You go into this beautiful uncertainty. Who knows what's going to happen next? So you don't try and predict the future. And that's living life from the heart. Being open, your heart is open to whatever's going to happen next. The door of my heart is open to everything. Yes?
About the normal senses of the world and the mind and meditation. You focus on the senses and the mind is weak and then awareness of the mind comes up. It seems to me that it's very pertinent to that question you just asked there. But, you know, we oftentimes, especially in Western society, we're trained to go about our life in a certain methodical manner, ruled especially by logic, especially if we've had a Western education. It seems to me, you know, if you think about what happens in deep meditation, it's not a very logical thing. It's something that seems to sort of pop up in terms of like little flashes, and it seems to be of its nature intuitive. And I was just wondering whether, in fact, there is a process that occurs as you go deeper and deeper into meditation, that your life starts to be ruled by a different set of rules, which are not logical, not really more to do with the heart. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, I suppose so, because logic is just reasoning, which comes from thinking. And it's one of the insights which I got from doing science. But what appears reasonable, what appears logical, sometimes isn't true. It's like quantum science was completely illogical, but it was true. You can sort of challenge it. And because of that, it was your logic, your reason was faulty. You didn't have a proper framework for your logic to begin with. And that's why sometimes quantum theory is just so weird and strange. But that's why I loved it. Because it really stretched and challenged what I thought was obviously true, what was logical, what was reasonable. I realized you can't trust logic, you can't trust reason. But in meditation you have to go much more to that, you say the intuition, the feeling, the pure knowing. The knowing before the words. And that is by far more accurate, more truthful. But more than that, when you go into deep meditation, you are suppressing the five hindrances which bend the truth to fit, to suit you. And too much of our logic is actually bent by wishful thinking or by denial. That's why we have arguments with each other. And your argument is absolutely logical, it's reasonable. That's why you can't understand my argument, because I think my argument is also reasonable. And how could both reasonable arguments be have opposite conclusions? Because we both bend our logic and reason to suit our wishful thinking or our denial.
That will, unsure will.
That's not part of will, yeah. Will is being bent by our defilements. So when we suppress especially the five hindrances, and with that comes the will, we're not actually challenging the world, we're not trying to change the world to suit us. We're seeing the world as it truly is. To see things as they really are. Not as we want them to be, not as we expect them to be, not as we hate them to be, but as they are. So that's truthfulness. And that's seen before logic starts to weave this web of thoughts and ideas.
Is the implication of that then that one begins to, as one goes and hangs out in deeper places more regularly in meditation, one begins to spill over into an experience of living life without will?
A living life without
willfulness,
yeah. One starts living life without wanting to control it so much. You're more able to allow things to be. You're not so blown around by the disappointments of life. You know, whether it's losing a loved one, whether it's losing your job, whether it's getting into jhana or getting completely frustrated because nothing happens at all in the whole retreat. You're not blown around by that anymore. You're not controlling, you're not demanding. So you're more able to be at peace with anything. Your own death, with pain and disappointment, that's the way. Welcome to life. So you don't try and control. You have this terrible wishful thinking, I shouldn't be like this. I shouldn't be like this, I should be much better than I am. So you're just who you are.
Also seems so, that one, as we move towards that space of less willfulness in life, that there's a large degree of serendipity that starts to occur. You just can't track it with logic, that funny things start to occur.
Yeah, that serendipity is just good karma, because one of the best good karmas is letting go and be at peace with things. All about keeping precepts, all about letting go of like your willfulness. Just charity, to letting go of your possessions, sharing. So it's not me, it's us. So we help each other. That's called letting go. Okay, here we go, another question coming up now. Theater, may I develop metta and compassion as I've seen in you? This is my goal. Thank you, with metta. Say, well, you've got metta. Say, thank you, with metta. So don't you develop it anymore. Yes, you can develop compassion, you can develop metta, and you can develop nimitta at exactly the same time. Because metta is actually how you see me teach, and how you see me in your interviews, how many people have come into interviews, and either you've cried, or you've moaned, or you say I'm really terrible, or you've said I've been thinking too much, or I've been sleeping too much, or I haven't been sleeping. And how many of you have I told off? And said, you stupid disciple, don't do that. You see, I've never done that to any one of you. Sometimes you say those things, that's very good. Say, you know, I haven't meditated at all, but all through goes, oh, that's very good. I say that because that's the door my heart's open to whatever you do. Because I do that because my loving kindness, my metta, my acceptance, my letting go of what you're doing, hopefully is going to rub off and you're going to let yourself do whatever you're doing. So you're not being willful, you'll be peaceful. You're having loving kindness, good passion to yourself. I told many of you to look at your mind like a little baby and to stroke your mind. Oh, poor mind. You're trying so hard. Getting up all big and just have to deal with all these problems come up. Oh. So you stroke your mind and be compassionate. Then you get into deep meditation. I used to fight my mind, you wouldn't get anywhere. and you're kind to it, it's my best friend. So we hang out together, we go everywhere together. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. Was being a Brahma the most immediate previous life of the Buddha? There are Jataka stories and stories of how the Buddha gave his body to the hungry tiger. Story of how the king sought his body up, etc. Are these just stories to make Buddhism more interesting when making a point about virtues, or are there past rebirths of the Buddha before he was a Brahmin during the Buddha Kassapa's time? Most grateful. Now, some of the stories you see in the Jataka probably real, but some of them are made up. Some of them are just myths, which actually, you know, the Buddha got involved in them, because we have something which people have seen in Western history called hagiography. Hagiography, when you take sort of like a teacher and you make him into a big saint, something he never was. Because what happens, you know, say you're a disciple of Ajahn Brahm, and you go off to see someone else who disciples somebody else. You would say, oh, my teacher is much better than your teacher. And you go, really? My teacher, I can see him meditate. Oh, that's nothing. I see him fly right up to the roof. Oh, I do fly. We tend actually to exaggerate. And this is actually what happened once with Ajahn Chah, with hagiography, when you sort of embellish the teacher's achievements. There's one of the famous stories of Ajahn Chah that on the moon night, when everybody was coming to the monastery to listen to a discourse during the rainy season, this was in the early days, a disciple came from town in their car, and as they were driving in, it was a rainstorm, and their car got bogged on the way in. And it was raining really hard, like monsoon rain outside. They didn't know what to do, they couldn't sort of get the car out. And through the rain, they saw Ajahn Chah come. The great teacher himself came and got behind the car and pushed the car out of the bog. And they thought, isn't it amazing, just even though he's a big teacher, how humble he can be and how compassionate, even though he's going to get really dirty and wet in his robes. What a wonderful, kind thing that was. So they're really impressed. But they obviously couldn't stop to come and thank him, because now they get bogged again, so they carried on. And when they sort of came to the hall, they looked in the hall, and there was Ajahn Chah sitting. They were doing the Patimokkha recitation. And Ajahn Chah was completely dry. They thought, the psychic power! Ajahn Chah, while he was sitting in the hall, that he must have seen our distress, and he sent his mind-made body or some apparition to push us out. It must be, because we saw him with our own eyes, and now we see him sitting there absolutely dry. And that was one of the famous psychic power stories of Ajahn Chah, which went around the whole of Ubon, one of the famous ones. But Ubon is where the nearest town. Now the true story, what actually happened, Ajahn Chah has got a relation, who's like cousin, who looks very much like him, who was a novice at the time. And being a novice, he didn't need to go into the meeting. It was actually him, who actually saw the car, oh, you know, I'm a novice, I can do these things, I can help them. And notice, he pushed the car out through the rain, it was in the darkness. The fellow thought that was Ajahn Chah. And after this novice heard this, he went and told him, no, look, it wasn't Ajahn Chah that time, it would be great if it was, but it was me, you've got to be honest. He told everybody, but no one would believe it. Because they preferred believing. Psychic power! And that's one of the problems, it's called hagiography. There's a perfectly reasonable explanation, but people preferred sort of the psychic one. And that's what you've got to be very, very careful of. And that's obviously, that would happen to the Buddha, that happens to everybody. Oh, yeah, I've got to be very careful now. Can I answer the question? He read my mind. I'm sure he read my mind. He was talking to me. Well, you know, you see someone else who looks, you know, a little bit lightly passing by. That's what Ajahn Brahm in here. Now he's over there. Psychic power, psychic power. People want to see psychic power so much. So, wishful thinking just bends the truth. And that's one of the problems. And that would have been the case with the Buddha as well. Some of those old tales, we would have actually said, oh, that must have been a Buddha. But the point is that some of the tales are true, some aren't true.
But even today, there are people who sacrifice body parts, like this kidney hacker. His driver donated a kidney to him or some such thing. And so many people are, you know, they have one good kidney and one diseased one, and yet they, you know, give their good kidney to somebody else. So,
yes, sometimes people are
like
that. But it's compassion to actually to help other people. But if you just give a kidney to somebody else, does that really help? Is that just prolonging a life a few years? Isn't it better to give dharma, to give food, to give, you know, real wisdom, peace? And they say that, you know, if you give a person a fish, you feed it for one day. If you teach a person for fish, you let them do bad karma for the rest of their lifetime. If I could teach a person dhamma, that's the best gift of all. So sometimes if you give a person a kidney, it's a wonderful thing to do, but can't you give something more than that? Give the gift of dhamma, to freedom. So giving your body to a tiger would be much better for actually to give the tiger 5 precepts.
How do you actually find the borderline between, you know, when you're talking about other things, between paying due respect for a mind like such as yourself and not getting into the preciousness of that?
Yeah,
it's like paying due respect but not be, you know, building up on sort of cloud and all.
You pay respect to the Dharma, you never pay respect to the person. So it's not, you don't worship, you know, the body. You worship the teachings. That's what the Buddha always said. You don't worship a Buddha or pay respect to a Buddha with candles, flowers and incense. You pay respect to a Buddha by following his teaching, putting it into practice. Now sometimes we just take the person, we worship the person. In Buddhism, we don't worship the person, we worship the Dhamma. That's why the Buddha said that famous saying, whoever sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. Whoever sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. The teachings, which are important. Not sort of Siddhartha Gautama, not the two legs, the two arms, the head and the body. That's not important at all. It's the teachings. So you can worship the teachings, but never worship the teacher. Okay, next question. In the Tibetan tradition, the Dalai Lama keeps being reborn and found again, and for the cause of Tibetan independence. Is this considered a form of attachment? Isn't it time to get out of the womb and relearn everything again? Is there a chance that in one birth the consciousness strayed by sexual pleasures, or is this like enlightenment but postponed for a cause? Please do not answer this question if it causes conflict in traditions, as this is Tate.
That's this one, isn't it?
That's a tape one. No, it's okay. I don't mind causing conflicts. It's just it's usually the case that, you know, coming back again is sort of attachment. It's much better to teach the Dhamma. The person is not important. You don't have to come back again. It's the teachings I recorded. So the person itself is not important. That's why the Buddha never came back again. The Dharma was there. He who sees the Dharma sees the Buddha. So why does the body need to come back ever again? The Dharma is still there, and that's the real Buddha. It's not the blood and the bones and the head and the eyelashes or whatever. That's not the Buddha. It's the teachings. So that's why the person doesn't need to come back again as long as the Dharma, the teachings, are strong enough to survive. So the Buddha said he set the wheel of teachings in motion. And those wheel of teachings were so well set in motion, he said it cannot be stopped by anybody now. So the wheel's in motion. And he knew it was going to go on for a long, 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 long time. That was enough. You don't need to come back again. What's the point? When the Dhamma is still in motion. The teachings are important, not the people, not the persons. But sometimes we forget that and say, oh no, we want you to come back again. That's really stupid. It's the teachings which you're worshipping, which inspire you. not the person. Okay, next question. All right, got out of that tricky one. Okay. Over the last 24 hours or so, on and off, the area around my third eye has felt unusually pressured. My way to deal with this has been to be content, but it's distracting and not comfortable though. When I focus on it, eventually ceases. Is it somewhat distracting? Can you please make some comment? Thank you, Ajahn. Okay, if your third eye really opens, you won't have to ask questions again. You'll know through your psychic powers the answers. And we'll be able to communicate on the psychic plane. No. I don't know about this third eye business, that's definitely not anything about that. Two eyes is enough. But sometimes what actually is happening there, if something is, the mind is getting strong, because of what we've read before, because we add, what we add on to reality, sometimes can feel that something's happening there. But that's just a perception which we add on to reality. There's no third eye in the middle of your forehead. But sometimes, because that's what we've been taught, sometimes that's how it can be felt. That's how it can be interpreted. So what the person is feeling there is real and valid, but to understand exactly what's going on, it's not anything to do with the body, it's to do with the mind. So if that's actually happening and you're getting very, very peaceful and you're getting sort of very powerful mind, it's just the mind becoming powerful. The third eye actually is not an eye which is on your body, it's the eye of the mind. The eye of the Dhamma chakra, the eye of the Dhamma. So sometimes we don't exactly know where that is, and so the mind just places it somewhere on the body, because that's what you've been told. You don't have to believe in what's been told, just go for the opening of the Dhamma eye inside. Dear Ajahn, this morning you said that when we die we should just allow the nimitta to envelop us, allowing the mind to be still, no thought. You said if we think, then this will take us to a new birth. The description of the law of Buddhism enlightenment started with remembering past lives, then karma, then Four Noble Truths. How is enlightenment possible when we die? If we allow the nimitta to envelop us, don't we need insight to arise the same as the Lord Buddha had with past lives, etc.? Or other suggestions suggested death practices are to contemplate anicca dukkha anatta. Very good. To contemplate anicca dukkha anatta is great, but sometimes that can be too much thinking, and we're not really seeing the three characteristics of impermanent non-self and suffering, but you're just thinking about it. Remember, it's the difference between the menu and the food. And sometimes when we don't know the difference between the menu and the food, we think the thoughts are the thing in itself. So we think anicca dukkha anatta, anicca dukkha anatta, anicca dukkha anatta, but nothing happens. So instead of actually thinking, we can actually see it. We know what anatta is. We know what the mind is. We see things disappearing, changing. That's by far more powerful. You can say those things, but make sure they just use a signpost so you can see deeply into things. That's the way to go. Dear Ajahn, please help! The more I know about meditation, the more I know I do not know. Question for meditation, ignorance is bliss, or ignorance breeds uncertainty. I'll take your advice and be patient. My mind is totally spoiled by me over the years and needs time to nurture it back to stay still. Thank you very much. Yeah, very good. So, not ignorance, it's like stillness. Sometimes he who thinks doesn't know. When you're still, then you can see. So that's what we really need to do. Just actually be so still, so we can see. And I'll be talking about deep insight tomorrow. It's more you thought you knew about meditation. But sometimes the people thought they knew what birth was. But when you come here, you find out what it truly is like. Like I was saying a few days ago, when I saw my first books on New Zealand, I thought, what a beautiful, pretty country it was. And I thought I knew where I was going. But on those photographs in the glossy brochures, you could not see the sandflies. When you went there, it was very different than on the brochures. Those sandflies would eat you alive. So sometimes your ideas and reality is completely different. So you may think you know what meditation is, but when you actually get into it, only then you know what it truly is. Tibetan Mahayana monks suggest that initiation would be necessary to embark on certain aspects of meditation, such as on the subject of dying. What is your advice on this? Okay, you are already initiated. Initiated just means you begin. And sometimes people need ceremonies to begin. That's all it is, ceremonies. But sometimes there's too many ceremonies. And so sometimes you try and keep it more simple. Sometimes initiations take days, but all it really is a skillful means to try and get your mind prepared. But it's not really necessary. So you keep it simple. You keep it pure, like in the time of the Buddha. So, you know, you can have initiation if you want, but you know, you have been initiated. Initiated just means you started. So initiation means you started a long time ago, so you are initiated. But sometimes we think that the teacher gives you power. That somehow the great master or the great Ajahn can actually give you the transmission of power to make it possible. And sometimes when you have that sort of idea, it means you always need a teacher, you always need a lama, and then I can charge you a lot of money for that. Because only great teachers, only great lamas, only monks who are trained in the jungles of Thailand, and the great masters like Ajahn Chah can do this for you. So it makes me very popular, and I can charge heaps, because this is special. There's only a few of us left who were trained under Ajahn Chah in the jungles. That's like priestcraft, which means that only a certain group of people have the power to, you know, give you enlightenment. And you see, that's what happens with like Catholic priests or Anglican priests or rabbis, or Brahmin priests. It's like they hijack the franchise. Yeah, so that's really awful when you do that. Religion should be free. It should be empowering you. So what you're actually doing there is, you don't need a monk to empower you. The Dharma empowers you. You can actually be initiated just by saying, now I'm going to start. It's like when I did the five precepts. When I first took the five precepts, it was in the Thai temple in London many, many years ago. Actually, but when it happened, I'd been visiting that Thai temple for a long time. One day the monk comes, you've been coming here a long time, you should take the five precepts. And I said, sir, what are the five precepts? A new meditation, you're something about Buddhism. And he said, the five precepts, not to be killing a living being. I said, I'm a vegetarian, I've been a vegetarian for a while now, don't eat anything. Not stealing, I'm very, very honest. Not committing adultery, I don't do that. Not lying, I haven't lied for a long time now. Not taking alcohol or drugs, I gave those up a couple of years ago. So I've been keeping them for many years. What do I need to take them for? I said to the monk, I said, take them anyway. But what was the point of taking those five precepts? I found them out by myself. They made so much sense to me. That's why I was keeping them. But you know, I did that just to make the monk feel happy. But you didn't need to, because why do you need initiation? When?